Tonight we're going to think about global warming. So there's a controversy raging in the broader evangelical community about the stewardship of the creation. And this split is also a struggle between generations, with many of the younger evangelicals calling for movement on a broader environmental agenda, including global warming, and many of the older generation warning that the emphasis on environmentalism is a dangerous distraction from what the church's primary focus should be, and that is the salvation of souls. It's no doubt that the large majority of the fundamentalists would side with the older evangelicals who believe that we have to guard against worshiping the creation instead of the Creator. However, it could be that much of our skepticism about global warming is based on a general distrust of science, because we figure, well, if you know scientists are wrong about evolution, maybe they're wrong about everything, and maybe we should just believe everything. And I think that's a possibility. Now, we're all familiar with the video footage of melting glaciers and those poor polar bears that have to swim more and having trouble finding food. And the experts are not encouraging. One professor in University of Queensland says that, for example, that the Great Barrier Reef's coral would disappear in as little as 20 years as sea temperatures rise faster than expected. So it's easy for people in the pew to be scared, to be concerned, and alarmed as the bad news keeps rolling in. So Christians want answers to basic questions about global warming from someone other than Al Gore. So how serious is it? What causes it? What, if anything, should we do about it? Now, I speak as one who's taught about global warming on a university level for more than 20 years. And I started teaching about it before it became a political subject and was mainly a scientific subject. And I want to be able to put global warming in its proper scientific and biblical perspective tonight. First, we need to understand. Can I go one more? No. First, we need to understand that the most amazing fact about global warming is how little variation there is in the Earth's climate. The Bible tells us that God created the Earth to be a home for mankind. Isaiah 45 and verse 18 says, "For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else." So the earth is made for human habitation. And he has made it in such a way that it's not going to get, you know, too hot for human habitation. God's also promised the earth will continue as a suitable habitation for mankind with regular seasons until the end. So if you remember, Noah comes off the ark, he builds an altar to the Lord, he sacrifices some very endangered animals, and then the Lord makes a promise. He says, "While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." And so we have God's promise on that. So we don't have to worry about, you know, things are going to warm up so much that we're not going to be able to live here. So the amazing thing is that God keeps this energy balance. And there's a lot of things to balance. We see here a slide showing that all the discussion, all the political turmoil, everything we've been discussing is because of a 1 degree change in global temperatures in the last 100 years. 1 degree, that's what we're talking about here. You might be forgiven to think that it was more than that, but it's 1 degree. You see the variation that takes place there. Even in your coldest winters or your warmest summers and so forth, you rarely get a change in temperature of more than a half a degree either way from a cold winter or a warm summer off the normal averages worldwide. And so in order to maintain this global balance of temperature, God has to do something really spectacular. He has to balance all the energy inputs that come into the earth. Let me give you an example of this. Now, this is kind of a busy slide here, and it's not important to you read every little part on that, but I was just trying to illustrate the fact there are a lot of things that God has to balance in keeping the temperature the same. For example, the amount of radiation arriving from the sun and the moon. Yes, the moon, because some of the light bounces off the sun and off the moon and goes to the earth. You know, the earth is the only planet circling our sun on which life we know, as we know it, could and does exist. If the earth had a little different mass, if it traveled a little faster, a little slower around the sun, all life would cease to exist. Most people are unaware that the Earth's orbit around the sun is nearly circular. We say in science it has an eccentricity of 1.7%, which is very low, say compared to Pluto, which has an eccentricity of 24.8%. There's an extremely narrow range of possible temperature, pressure, atmospheric composition, and so forth that must exist in order to sustain life as we know it. The precision of the Earth's orbit about the sun can be demonstrated by the fact that the Earth's 365-day, 6-hour, 9-minute, 9.54-second, 66,600-mile-per-hour round trip around the sun varies by less than a hundredth of a second each year. Terrific precision. If we saw that kind of precision with a watch, we'd certainly believe the watch had a designer. Okay, and of course, the Earth-Sun system has a designer, the Creator God. Also, if the Earth rotated on its axis much slower, all life would die, either by freezing at night because of lack of heat during the longer night, or by burning up during the day from too much sun. And then God balanced the diffusion of heat energy into outer space by convection and radiation. Reflecting of incoming radiation is about 40%. Absorption by the atmosphere is 20%. Absorption by land and water is another 40%. And yet, of all the energy that the sun produces, the Earth only picks up 0.45 billionth of its output, okay, because of how far away the sun is from the Earth. Jupiter, for example, radiates into space twice as much heat. The Earth is, pretty much takes in as much as it gives out. But Jupiter gives out twice as much heat as it takes in. And that's true for Uranus and for Saturn, all these gas giant planets. How would these planets be able to give out more heat than they take in for 4.6 billion years? Now, there's no explanation. There's no mechanism. It's not nuclear reactions or anything, because we can measure that. And so there's no explanation of how these planets are supposed to be so old and yet still give off so much heat. But on the Earth, we have this critical balance of forces that drive the hydrological cycle, the rains, the rivers, the winds, the glaciers, the snow. And then God balanced the Earth's core, heat from the decay of radioactive isotopes in the Earth's crust also has to be balanced. So of all the energy coming from the inside of the Earth, half of it comes from radioactive elements that are decaying, and the rest is energy that's already was created in place. Then we have the conversion of gravitational energy to thermal energy. So when it rains, you're converting potential energy to kinetic energy. That adds heat. You have kinetic energy produced by the tides, as the waves crash against the margins of the continents and over rocks and so forth. Even the land itself, the land is rising and falling tidally as well, and rocks are grinding inside the Earth's crust and producing heat. That has to be balanced for as well. And yet, even though we have all this heat being produced, you would expect it to slow down the orbit, the rotation of the Earth. We talked about that the other night. We were talking about the moon. We'd expect the Earth to slow down because of the tidal forces. And yet, the length of an Earth day has increased by only 0.2 0.002 seconds per century. 0.002 seconds per century. And so that the Earth's rotational energy loss is balanced almost exactly by the absorption of outside energy, particularly from the outer planets like Jupiter. So those planets, you know, I hope when you have your devotions in the morning, you thank the Lord for Jupiter, because it plays an important role in life on Earth. It's like a cosmic vacuum cleaner. It sucks up a lot of rocks and things that would have hit us otherwise, and also balances out these tidal forces. So God has designed the whole solar system to give us, you know, uniform temperatures on Earth. And then there's the enormous capacity of the Earth's oceans. Earth's oceans, 71%, to store thermal energy. And all of you live in Washington because of that fact, okay? You think about, you know, where Washington is compared to other places in the country, you know, like Minnesota or someplace, and you have this relatively mild climate. Why? Because you got all that water out there. All that water out there can absorb and release heat and keeps the temperature here fairly temperate. That has to be balanced as well. And the heat capacity of water is, as we've seen, 10 times larger than steel, for example. And so this molecule, this water molecule, is really a miracle molecule because God designed it to allow life on Earth, to have this great heat capacity. And it's so the molecule itself is designed so that we can live on this planet. I like this verse. Psalm 24, 1 and 2, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein, for he hath founded it upon the seas and established it upon the floods. Without that water molecule, life would not be possible on the earth for many, many different reasons. Then we have the existence of the North and South Pole ice sheets, which if melted would submerge large portions of land. We know the average height of the Earth's surface is only about 0.8 kilometers, if you averaged it out. And so without that, those polar ice caps, if that all melted, a lot of the land where people live, you know, goodbye Florida, for example. And then the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is important for life as well. Heat trapped by water vapor, carbon dioxide, other gases retard the escape of long-range wave radiation from the Earth's crust. It's like being in a car on a hot day. So I had a student from Guam, and I was going along on campus, and I saw she was in a parked car in Greenville, South Carolina. It was hot, and she had all the windows rolled up. She was sitting inside the car, and I said, you know, what are you doing? And she said, I was homesick. And so I got in the car and rolled the windows up so it would remind me of home. And I thought, I don't want to live in Guam, okay? Okay. But the greenhouse effect, if we didn't have a greenhouse effect, the temperature of the Earth would be some 36 degrees lower on average than it is now. So the greenhouse effect allows for life on Earth. And then the heat balance is also maintained by air currents, mixing hot air near the surface with cooler air aloft by means of convection. The tilt of the Earth, we talked about this on when we talked about the moon on Wednesday. It averages 23.5 degrees, deviates only plus or minus 1.5 degrees during a hypothetical 41,000-year period. If the Earth was not tilted, if it was straight up and down, what would happen is all the moisture would migrate to the poles and freeze there, and you'd have a desert in between. You'd have polar ice caps and just complete desert in between. Life, again, would not be possible without that tilt on the Earth. And as you know from what we talked about on Wednesday, it's the moon that stabilizes that tilt and allows allows us to have the seasons that we have. So, isn't it possible that man, through his actions, can upset this incredible precision that God has created? The current concern is that, humans are making more and more carbon dioxide by burning the rainforest, driving motor cars, burning fossil fuels for industry, and that temperatures will inevitably rise as the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere continues to rise. And there's a few things I want to say about. Why are people concerned about? Well, there's a couple of catastrophes they're concerned about with global warming. The first one is what we call thermohaline circulation. We talked about the ocean currents when we talked about the moon. But we have this conveyor belt of warm water, you see the red, that travels along the east coast of the United States. We call that the Gulf Stream. And it carries heat up to northern climates, and you see most of that heat is released to Europe. Okay, and then it comes back lower as cold water back underneath the hot water. So you have the warm current on top and the cold water underneath going back to where it came from. So these currents go all over the world and strongly affect the weather. So one of the funny things about global warming is if Greenland, you see Greenland, if all the ice in Greenland melted, it would pour all this cold, fresh water into the North Atlantic, and it would shut down this conveyor belt. And the result would be that Europe would freeze over like a popsicle. Okay, so one of the odd things about global warming is that some places would become much colder as a result of global warming. And so people don't think about that. I was at a global warming conference years ago before it became a political issue, and they had us all sitting at the table with some expert in global warming at the University of North Carolina. And so I said to the guy, if global warming is true, then what do you expect things to be like in the future? And he said, it'll either be hotter than normal or colder than normal or wetter than normal or drier than normal. And I went, like that, I made that sound, okay? And he wouldn't talk to me anymore, okay? But he's right. I mean, there is that aspect of it that some places will be colder because of global warming. So it's something to think about. The other thing to concern about is the Western Antarctic ice sheet, which is anchored on land. We're not worried too much about the ice that's in the ocean because just like an ice cube in a glass of water, it won't change the height of the water, you know, if it melts. But this Western Antarctic ice sheet, and you can see the places where the colors are showing where the Western Antarctic ice sheet is slipping off into the ocean, and it's slipping off faster and faster. One of the things that reason it's doing that is because under the Western Antarctic ice sheet are about 300 volcanoes, active volcanoes. And so it keeps the ice lubricated under there, and it really could go, you know, into the water and raise the ocean levels by about 20 meters, okay? Which is, you know, goodbye New York, goodbye Florida, goodbye Hong Kong, you know, and go around the world. And so a lot of places that people live would be underwater if that happens. And so scientists are concerned about that taking place because it seems to be taking place even today. The other thing I want you to see is this chart, if I can get it to stop there. There we go. So here are computer runs. When we have our big supercomputers, see the red line shows the climate model runs where they expect the global warming to go. And this was done some time ago, and you can see the predictions. And then you can see what actually happened as far as global warming is concerned. One is from balloons and one's from satellites. And what you see is they're very poor at predicting what's going to happen with their computers. Okay? And that's the reason I call myself a global warming agnostic. Okay? I'm probably the first agnostic that's ever preached at your church. Okay? And the reason I'm, and probably the only one that's ever worn a picture of Albert Einstein on his tie. you can't see the pipe here, okay? He's smoking a pipe. So why am I not a global warming agnostic? Because our scientific techniques, our computer models, are unable to tell us how much of the global warming, if any, is a result of man's activities. We're just not good enough to get that, tease that information out. And so, I mean, that's really the political issue. How much of the global warming we see, everybody agrees that things are warming up, but how much of that global warming is because of what man is doing? And it's impossible to tell, okay, as far as I can tell, as a scientific issue. So if we're interested in global warming, if you're concerned about it, well, the Bible tells us there's the effect of the greatest, we talked about this the other night, the greatest pollutant on the earth, and that is man's sin. Genesis 6:5, and God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. And that's what caused God to send the flood and the judgment of the flood, which certainly destroyed a lot of things, in fact, the whole earth. Well, what would we expect? As Bible-believing Christians, what do we expect about global warming? And what we'd expect is, as I mentioned the other night, we have warm water during the flood. We have a lot of volcanoes going off. You have a lot of ash in the air. You get cold air. When you get cold air or warm water, you get these big snowstorms, and you start building glaciers in the middle of the continents. And until the water cools down, it's going to take several hundred years, or maybe 500 or 600 years, for it to cool down to the temperatures we have today, that we're going to have an ice age. The ice age is caused by the global flood. Somebody says, well, how long was the ice age? And the answer is, we're still in the ice age, because we still have ice in Antarctica and in Greenland. Those are still left over from the ice age. And they're melting. All the measures we have show that those are melting. Now, it goes back and forth. Sometimes it builds up, sometimes it melts more. It goes back like this. But the general trend is toward melting. And the general trend toward temperatures on the Earth is too warm. I mean, it only be 1 degree for 100 years, but the general trend over time has been for things to be warming up. So that's what I would expect as a Bible-believing Christian. What we see is consistent with what Paul said in Romans 8:22, and that is, for we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain until now. So the context is of believers in this sinful world with all their aches and pains waiting to be redeemed and given a new body. So the earth is under the curse of sin and groans and is decaying, waiting for a time of renewal. The earth is running down, as we talked about thermodynamics, the downward direction of the world. So how about the future? What can we expect? Is it possible, as we rapidly approach the tribulation period and the return of Christ, that the judgments of that period will become increasingly evident? I read in Revelation 16, verse 8, and the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun, and power was given unto him to scorch men with fire. I mean, talk about global warming. Okay, here we have global warming. It's clear that the tribulation period will be a time of great climate change. It's also clear that it's not man-made, except in the sense the judgment comes because of man's sin. So, what should be our position as to the political and economic aspects of the global warming debate? Knowing this first, that shall come in the last day, scoffers walking after their own lust. And these scoffers, it tells us, don't believe in a couple things. They don't believe that God created the heavens and the earth, standing out of water and in the water, and the world. And they don't believe in the flood. They don't believe the worldwide judgment of the flood. And they also don't believe that the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. So what do we know about these scoffers? We're told that they walk after their own lust. That is, they have a strong desire for money, fame, prestige, and power. Could this describe some of the politicians and corporate leaders who are pushing for action on global warming. So I'd ask my students, which corporation do you think is pushing for action on global warming more than any other corporation in our country? And so I say, well, you know, follow the money. Which corporation has the most money to gain? And they usually come up with the right answer, and that is General Electric. Why General Electric? Because they make windmills. Okay, so they're pushing for renewable resources because it lines their pockets. They make money off of it. And you can always follow the money and find out where the political pressures go. Politicians who promote action for political or financial gain, companies that have financial stake in alternative energy sources, middlemen in the carbon trading schemes, those promoting one world government, and scientists who wish to receive grants for global warming research are all on that same team. And we find that these scoffers in 2 Peter 3 deny the literal return of Christ. They're ignorant of the ways of God as revealed in the scriptures. Verse 5 tells us that they are willfully ignorant and that they deny the judgment of a worldwide flood caused by God. So what they do, they believe that man rather than God is ultimately in control of the climate. Okay? So what they're saying as uniformitarianists, they would say that everything continues on in cycles in a natural way, and when things get out of kilter, it's because of man's activities. Now, the uniformitarian idea is that some outside agency must cause these changes, and that outside agency is man. Okay, so they take it upon themselves to say it's man that's causing the global warming that we see. So they view things that we see on Earth, including droughts and floods, can be understood by looking back over the ages. It's nothing new that happens, just goes in cycle. Everything just rolls along by itself. But they believe then that the world just follows natural laws. Nothing out of the ordinary happens. And if it does, then it must be because of man's activities. Rather than admit that God can step into an ordered world, they come up with the theory that it's man with his industry and automobiles has broken the uniform cycles and placed their planet in jeopardy. And therefore, it's man that has to fix the problem. Well, even if we accept the idea, I told you I'm a global warming agnostic, but let's just say that it's man's fault. Okay? Let's just seed that idea. So it's a little hard to see with the size of these things, but on the left-hand side, you see the total cost of mitigating global warming, various plans and so forth. The one on the right-hand side is a 1.5 degree increase, okay? In order to keep it at a 1.5 degree increase, you would have to spend $37.6 trillion, okay, in order to mitigate it. This is based on year 2000 dollars. So what I'm saying is that there's not enough money in the whole world to do anything about it. And then you see on the right-hand side, you see these various scenarios, various carbon trading schemes, and limits to 2.5 degrees Celsius. And what you see there is the result by 2100 AD. Yes. Okay. I forgot. Yes, sorry. Thank you. So what you see here, thank you. So you see that there's very little difference there as far as this is 1.5 degrees, this is 2 degree change right here. And so there's very little difference between those scenarios. So essentially what I'm telling you is economically speaking, there's nothing that can be done about it. It doesn't matter what you believe about who's to blame for global warming. We can't do anything about it without throwing everybody out of work. So like in Australia, where we spent so much time, the government decided to put in a carbon trading scheme. Okay, so what they did was they put the carbon trading scheme in and they drove their whole cement industry out of business. And all those workers lost their jobs. Now Australia buys all their cement from China. But China doesn't have any safeguards on their CO2 emissions. And so the Chinese cement factories produce 10 times more CO2 than the Australian ones did. Okay, so as a it doesn't make any sense from a political or environmental or any other kind of point of view. There's nothing can be done from it about it from an economic point of view. Okay, so what should we do? Well, you know, we can not build on the coast. Okay, that would make a lot of sense. Okay, we'd make it expensive for people to build on the coast, not offer them flood insurance and that type of thing. So, you know, those houses won't get swept away by every storm that comes inland. We can take that money, if we want to spend that money on something, we know that there's things that we can spend that money on that have proven outcomes. We could take the same amount of money and we could provide clean water and sewerage for third world people all over the world and save millions and millions of people's lives. We know, because we know we've done this kind of thing before. And so to spend that money on something that has so little chance of making any dent in the problem, it just doesn't make any sense. And the idea that we live in the best of all possible worlds. I mean, we know that when Paul landed on Malta, it was a jungle, okay? Now you go to Malta, there's hardly a tree you can find, okay? So it's a desert now. And we know that the Sahara Desert used to be a jungle as well, and that we find the skeletons of hippopotamus and crocodiles, and we've seen that there are cities in the Sahara Desert. So Sahara Desert used to be habitable, and now it's dried out, okay? I'm sure those people that lived there at that time thought, well, this is the best of all possible worlds. But we need to get used to the idea that things are warming up, and you know, maybe we'll grow wheat further into Canada. You know, maybe you know, the crops will shift north and so forth. And so we have to do as we've always done as human beings, adapt to change. This idea that we force our politicians to believe in global warming and then they turn around and build big houses on the beach, you know, just shows how hypocritical the whole thing is. They don't really believe it themselves. So let's think about some questions here we dealt with. First of all, do we also have the spirit of the scoffer? Do we, as we live our lives day by day, getting up in the morning, going to work, and going about our normal activities, do we also not believe that God can enter into our world and change things? And I'm afraid a lot of times, even as Christians, we don't take into account that God yet does and will enter into our lives in unexpected ways, according to his own purposes. Do we know the difference between climate and weather? So people in the wintertime, you know, there's a cold snap or something, oh, this is, you know, and they laugh, this is global warming and all this kind of thing. But when we talk about climate, we're talking about long-term changes. We're not talking about, you know, weather events, okay? There's a difference between those. Do we believe God's promise in Genesis 8:22, this general principle that while earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease? Do we believe the earth is cursed? Do we believe that the whole earth groans and travails in pain, weakened under the curse of sin and man's stewardship until Christ steps in? And Christ will return. My mother, who passed away this year, was 100 years old. And one of the things she would always ask me, she says, how come nobody preaches about the rapture anymore? She says, I remember when I was a young girl and so forth that preachers always preached about the rapture. And how come nobody preaches about the rapture today? And I'm afraid that's largely true. I know in my own church, we very rarely hear about the rapture. It's not topmost in our minds. We're not anticipating his return. I dare say most of us who came tonight are not thinking that the Lord could come back before we go back home again. Okay, but that's the way we're supposed to think. We're supposed to think the Lord could intervene at any time and come and take us home. Christ's literal return is certain. Our God is in control. Do you fear global warming or do you fear God? We have a great God. Is he a reality to you? Luke chapter 12, verse 4 says, and I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body and afterwards have no more they can do. But I will forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him which after he is killed has power to cast into hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. And so there's a lot of things to be more afraid of than global warming, especially of our of our God. And he's an awesome God. He's a God to be feared and to be revered. And we need to understand where we stand as far as he's concerned.